Welcome to the Workflow Show, episode 105. I'm Merrill Davis, and along with Nick Gold, today we're going to talk about MAMS.
Media Asset Management.
We like to say just the facts, ma'am. What exactly is Media Asset Management?
It's related to two other phrases that seem to have taken root when talking about this sphere of technologies. It's actually a sphere that hovers above your bed in the middle of the night and beams strange thoughts into your head.
It looks like a floating jellyfish.
So DAM.
Damn!
Digital Asset Management. So we've got MAM, Media Asset Management, DAM, Digital Asset Management, and now a new one. And this one, I think, was largely, what's the word, promulgated? Is that the right word?
Well, you said the word correctly. So if it is, you said it right.
I don't even know if that's a real word. I think it was really largely promulgated by Avid, PAM, or Production Asset Management.
So the common theme here is asset management, though, right?
Yes. And we're not talking like what Goldman Sachs does with your assets and like trading and options and not that kind of asset management here, although they do call that asset management. We're talking about the management of your media and data files, right?
Zeros and ones, folks.
Lots of them. We're chock full of zeros and ones. So when we talk about asset management here, this is a good segue in kind of the first section we wanted to talk about, the kind of two personalities of these systems and what the big picture is.
Sure. And personalities, would we categorize sort of the Jekyll and Hyde of MAM versus DAM?
Yeah, I was thinking more like Harvey, what's his name, Two-Face on Batman.
Oh, Dent?
Yeah, Harvey Dent.
Yeah, which shares the same last name as our president of our company, but I feel like that's inconsequential.
Mark Dent.
Yes.
I tell him he should have like an auto body repair shop. So here are the two main things that these systems do. We'll break down a little more the difference between MAM, DAM, and PAM, but...
Damn!
You're going to keep saying that.
Yes, I am.
So the first is the database-driven approach to organizing your files. You know, for really, let's call it logging and search functionality, but using a database, right? Versus just... Well, we'll get into the verses of the traditional way of doing it, but it's this searching capability, being able to find things very granularly and just have very quick access to the files that you work with in media production, right?
You know, I think that would be a good time to sort of pull back for a second. Why would I need that? Why would I need that level of granularity in my work?
Well, so let's talk about how a lot of people organize files today, right? We have file systems. File systems consist of drives, little hard drive icon on your desktop, or otherwise known as volumes. Within those volumes can have a name, right? So there's your first level of organization. Within those drives or volumes... You have a hierarchy that you maybe have organized, maybe, big fat M on that, maybe, because a lot of people don't do this very well, but maybe you've organized the system of folders and subfolders into a meaningful hierarchy on that volume, and those folders and subfolders kind of are logically organized and have names associated with them.
So say you're shooting... a reality show, and you've got your B-roll, you've got maybe day one of production, maybe day two of production, maybe specific talking head interviews, and then maybe some, you have a section also for, video from other sources, like, stock footage.
Absolutely. You may have subfolders and directories for different, entirely different projects you're working on. You may have different volumes for different projects you're working on. You may have, as you said, Merrill, different types of footage, different people you're interviewing in their own subfolders. Here's a shot
different
of
camera sources.
You name it, right? But you're using this series of folders and subfolders within them as kind of a level of organization. And again, ideally, you're naming these folder schemes something meaningful that helps you search, right? Within these folders, we have the files themselves, right? And those, again, not a lot of people do this terribly well, but you may have come up with a system for naming files that gives you some level of detail on what's in them. You may come up with a file naming scheme or convention where you are basically baking things into the file name, right?
You know, B-roll underscore, date underscore, camera source underscore, you know, whatever.
Well, and a nice good one, take. A nice one too is like if you're a customer that's constantly working on tons of projects, right? Maybe you come up with a unique project ID number for every unique project you're working on, and maybe you've baked that project ID number into file names or even folder names with, you know, within this directory structure. And you've got some level of organization, but this is basically all it consists of: volumes and their names, folders and subfolders and their names, and the files and their names. And that's basically all she wrote, right?
Right. And that's all contingent upon you.
Yeah, actually kind of doing it. But it's, I like to call it a very kind of two-dimensional approach to organization, right? You've got files and you've got folders and directories, basically.
It's like going to a doctor's office and putting everything in like, you know, the medical file in the wall.
Oh, and we've all seen how much of a mess that is.
That's true.
It takes them like 10 minutes to like find the record of my various...
missing tooth. I don't know.
It's funny. I was thinking of teeth.
You were thinking of teeth? I don't know. Me too.
I've had a lot of... well, not a lot of
missing
tooth problems.
We are in Hamden.
There's definitely some missing teeth prevalent in the neighborhood that Chesapeake is based out of.
I found a lot of them. They're usually in the street. So, okay. So that's pretty much the
so, but let's contrast
bare bones scenario
of reality for most people, right?
Yeah.
So here's what a database-driven approach does for you. With a database, it's ironic. The location of your files becomes a lot less relevant because you can come up with a plethora of categorizational,
promulgated,
you know,
plethora. You are all over it today, man.
I'm college educated and proud of it.
There you go. But so
I'm also from the Northeast, Massachusetts.
I see. Say no more. So, but
you see how my nose is kind of rising in the air a little bit.
Is that a New England thing?
So the database-driven approach basically lets you define how many dimensions you want to categorize your data, right? It's all about coming up with metadata and keywords and, you know, as we were talking about, right? You may have some folders that you maybe are using to organize things, but with metadata, you can have like various pop-up menus. So, you know, we have customers who are kind of doing campaign ads and things like that. You know, they have a metadata field for, you know, which, you know, is this a senatorial race, a congressional race, a presidential race? Okay, then which state is it in? What's the name of the candidate? You know, is this an interview? Is it this? Is it that? And they can have this like multi-dimensional set of fields and terms that they can use to kind of categorize all the different types of media that they're working with. And then because it's a database, they can very easily execute a search for things that meet certain criteria and not others. They're not limited to searching in terms of something that's in a particular folder at a particular time. They can now kind of have this, again, multi-dimensional approach of searching where, okay, I want to create a smart folder, and it's always going to show me everything from 2008 with this client and, you know, this type of footage that was shot during the day.
When you say smart folder, we're talking like, you know, the same kind of thing that's in iTunes that...
Yeah, it's the folder that's always showing you all of the Bob Dylan recordings from 1969. And every time you add a Bob Dylan recording that has Bob Dylan somewhere and 1969 in its metadata somewhere, you know that the next time you click on that smart folder, that new thing you added that happened to meet that criteria will just be there. No one had to drag it into that folder. The folder isn't a real folder sitting on a drive in a particular location. It's this constantly updating, dynamic, basically perpetual search result, if you will, that's always going to show you what meets the definition of that search, you know, at any given moment.
This has limitless capability. I mean, as you're saying this, I'm thinking about sort of the long-term documentarian. They're doing a two-year documentary. They've got video sources from all over the world, and they have upwards of 80 talking head interviews. And they finally get into post after 2 years of very long production. And just imagine the level of organization that would have to be manually done for them to get all the qualities that they need in all these various clips. But wouldn't it be great to be able to, for example, if you're shooting a documentary all around the world, sort by location of the shoot?
Yeah, and then more granularly, the day, the shooter.
I need Australia B-cam from August the 17th of 2010.
And the other thing is that these can be, like, that's an example of something pretty, in a sense, quantitative or very kind of yes, no. Something very clearly meets that definition. But you may have a set of tags that you generate that are maybe more qualitative in nature, like the type of thing being featured.
Underwater.
Or is this even good? What's the quality of the shot? Is it daytime, nighttime? Is there a lot of energy in this piece? Is there background music? You know, there's so you again. What you do when you come up or you evolve and move into one of these database asset management oriented approaches to dealing with your media is you kind of come up with a what we like to call a taxonomy or a series of kind of words and definitions that make sense for you, your specific projects, your organization.
It's like your own little personal Dewey Decimal System.
That's exactly what it is, man. Yeah. Except you don't actually have to go through like a card catalog.
Well, the card catalog's on your computer.
Got it. Some of those cards were so dirty. Like you, because you know Meryl and I are very old, and we actually
thanks. I appreciate
had
that.
Card
I'm
catalogs.
I'm 104, actually.
I'm 4,018.
Were you a Time Lord?
That's exactly correct, in my own mind. So you would open up a card catalog, but you know those had metadata. You open up a book, right? You may notice this on like the first couple of pages, the inside pages of a book. You open it up, you know, it could be an iBook, it could be a real book that's made of a dead tree. You'll see that there's like a few pieces of metadata associated with the Library of Congress and their tracking of that title.
Sure.
And you know, their system never made any sense to me. It's like you could get a book about like, you know, training your dog, and it'll be like.
I skipped out of my...
The philosophical epistemology of animal stuff. You're like, this is what the Library of Congress comes up with for metadata values? You're like, what the heck?
Well, you know, I skipped out on my library class in college. I just, I didn't see the practical application.
I worked
I'm
in the
sorry
library.
For all the librarians
I worked
out there
in the library both in
career.
College and in high school. And check it out, when I was like a real alternative little like high schooler, this was in a private school in New England.
So your idea of alternative is...
So I'd be like sitting back behind the librarian's desk, feet kicked up, check this out, because I was so cool, reading like 17 magazine. I'd be like, yeah.
I imagined you were reading something like Howl by Allen Ginsberg.
I was very, well, that it might have been like both, right? Because I was just hitting from all angles.
I see. So
I was very vague.
On the road again and makeup tips.
My identity was still coming into focus at
I
that
see
point.
I see. Did you take, you know, because I'll admit, you know, like 17 and Cosmo, like I would always, I'd never read any of this, but I would go to the quiz that's totally not appropriate for me anyway because I'm not a woman, and I would take the quiz, and I would try to answer it and see if I would pass the quiz, you know, can you please your man? And ostensibly the answer is no, I cannot.
That's too bad.
Yeah, you know, I tried.
So metadata terms... And being able to do a very kind of wide variety of searches to find maybe very granular bits of information. Oh, gosh. Remember in, you know, 2007, we had that shot from that other project that we can maybe
sunset,
use in this new one.
That sunset against the skyscraper. And
it
was just
I
the
know
right light.
It was 2007 because this happened and there was a sunset in it. And we were shooting in Austin at the time. Well, you know, in a media asset management system, that's not a matter of digging through, you know, thousands and thousands of files or opening up dozens of Final Cut projects.
And I've had that job, mind you.
Oh,
I've
yeah,
had that job.
Thanks.
You know, where I've walked into a post house and they said, hey, Meryl, why don't you sit down here? Here's 16 hard drives. We're looking for X, Y, and Z. If you don't mind opening up every single Final Cut project ever. Oh, and here are some Avid projects, too. And by the way, if you could jump on that Media 100 in the corner and maybe pull up some of those assets
it's
as well.
It's very time-consuming. It's the kind of task that you know, Meryl, that when a producer, whoever, asks you to do that, that's kind of when you pull out a nail and you consider sticking it in your eyeball.
Two nails, one for each eye.
They make a popping sound, though? See, this came up in discussion earlier today.
Do eyeballs make a popping sound?
We were talking about this Japanese movie and that
Battle Royale.
But in the book version, Merle was telling me that there's a very graphic scene of someone stamping on a skull, an eyeball popping out, and then popping the eyeball. But it made an audible sound.
I think it might have just been a poor translation, quite honestly, because it popped out of the skull. But I don't necessarily know that it made a sound. And I have not tried this in real life.
I just don't see the density of an eyeball being great enough to actually make a literal sound like that.
That's the sound it makes. It's
well, like we'll find out next week.
Yeah, I guess so.
In the putting out an eye episode, the workflow show.
So that's what somebody would categorize as.
Yeah, now we'll talk about the challenges of a DAM or a MAM system a little bit later.
Well, you say DAM or MAM.
Well, let's put the timeout on that. We're going to start popping some eyeballs. We'll get into the DAM, MAM, PAM thing in just a moment.
Okay.
But, you know, it's important to stress, in order to get these abilities to kind of search through your data in this very rich set of ways with these custom terms, someone's got to be tagging a lot of your stuff, logging essentially, but logging into a database, not just like an Excel spreadsheet or a Word document and making little notes about time code. They're putting all of this in a database. So it's taking these logging tasks that you have and kind of coming up with a new tool, but it's not necessarily totally changing the process. So, you know, it really is logging. It's just a putting these log notes into a rich database versus this file that is only semi-useful to you, right?
Right. And not only that, but garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah. Someone's got to actually do this. You've got to train staff to know what to tag with what terms.
You won't be able to look at that shot from 2007 in Austin unless you know that the people who are logging and tagging your videos are aware of all the metadata parameters. So
exactly.
You've got to make sure that the people who are at the helm of your database here know just how important and valuable these tags are, because they are what define
your ability to find them later on.
And without them, then, you know, like I said, garbage in, garbage out.
Well, I'll give you an example, right? Like a typo will totally keep you from finding something because someone spelled something wrong and you're searching for it correctly and they fat fingered it when they were doing the logging. So this is why when we're deploying one of these asset management database systems and we kind of have a set of customized metadata fields, we generally push people towards having a pop-up menu, right, where you have a predefined list of values that you can choose for a metadata field, but not necessarily making it completely open-ended, right? Because here's an example, right? Here's a shot. Is that a kid? Is it a child? Is it a boy? Is it a girl? Is it a little rapscallion? What's the term you want your users to tag on it? Well, if they have a pop-up menu and there's two values, adult and child, it's pretty easy to train your loggers to choose which of those terms is the appropriate one for any given shot. But if you just make it an open-ended text field,
they're going to put everything and anything.
And then they're going to spell it wrong. Yeah.
They're going to spell it wrong.
Because what editors know how to spell?
Most of them, though they don't manage to do it.
They spell in pictures.
I mean, the truth of the matter is anybody anywhere who's ever dealt with a database knows that this is an issue. This is not localized just to, you know, a MAM. This is, you know, financial database. This is a contacts database. This is, you know, if anybody's ever done any data entry into a database, this is an issue. And, it, you know, having predefined fields reduces that. Now, there might be an instance where you need at least one open-ended field, but Nick's very right in so much that predefined allows you to whittle down the selected parameters. I mean, you do that, and then you know that you have five key parameters that you can always search against versus potentially 100 or more.
Yeah, let's talk about that, right? So when putting together an asset management database and coming up with these metadata fields, you're going to get some metadata for free, right? And this is more of the technical metadata relating to the files. You know, things like the name of the file becomes a piece of metadata. The location on a drive within a certain folder is a piece of metadata that gets tracked in the database. But so are some other interesting things like the codec, the frame rate, the frame size, the file creation date, which is obviously usually going to give you a pretty good clue about when it was either shot on the camera, if it was a tapeless format and that was baked in from the beginning, or at least digitized, the digitization date, if it was something that originated from one of those old-fashioned things like videotape, if you remember those. I think they came shortly after wax cylinders.
This literally. Is why you're like 110?
I'm 4,018.
Oh, you're the Highlander, not a Time Lord.
There can only be one.
So,
mark my words.
That's true. That's very true. But
so you want to come up with like a set of fields that someone's actually going to have to log themselves. That, you know, I like saying it's like the Goldilocks principle. You don't want too few because then you can't search granularly enough, right? You're going to do a search for like two things and like 400 results come up and it's not going to save you that much time. You also don't want to make it like 20 fields worth of data or 30 that like some basic logger has to fill out because they ain't going to do it. Like it's too difficult. The training to get them up on exactly how to tag what, it's too much. You want the Goldilocks principle, not too much, not too little. You want just right. And we've found that for most kind of loggers or producers who might be involved in some of this activity, you really want like 5 to 10 tops qualitative metadata fields. Even if these metadata fields are like a checkbox that they check to indicate that something's B-roll or a checkbox they check and they have like a little grid of people's names in the project so they can just quickly check off who might be in a given shot. You know, you don't want to make them work too hard. They're not going to do it. And again, remember, a lot of the benefits of this search system comes down the line. It's when people have to find this data later on, maybe in the context of that post-production activity, maybe 3 years later or 5 years later when you're going into your archives looking for it. So you don't want to give the people who are charged with tagging these things too much to tag, because they might not necessarily see the direct benefits themselves. And you run into this whole angst situation where people are like, why should I have to tag this stuff? I'm not even using it. You're giving me this deadline and I got to get this in and I'm not seeing any benefit. It's the organization's benefit. It's the benefit to the guy who, as we were talking about before, wants to just, you know, hit his head on the desk because he's being asked to find something a couple years later that he now has to go through like a stack of FireWire drives because that's what your garbage archive consists of. And see the previous episode of the Workflow Show where we talk about how bad of an archive strategy that is. But, you know, you may be having to put an extra 30 seconds in on the front end to save you hours on the back end. So it's a strategic investment of a little upfront time to save you huge amounts of time later on.
And I would say this is entirely scalable. So in your example, we're talking about a post-production organization. You know, they are making a show, or they're they're generating something hour long for television. But at the same time, this is totally scalable. This could be for a guy who's a one-man band who shoots like a mother and still needs this flexibility. So it really doesn't stop based on the size of your project. It is
infinitely?
It is infinitely expandable, I think.
Yeah, and that's actually a good segue into differentiating a little bit Dan versus Mam versus Pam, because these systems are all similar in that they're all talking about kind of a database-driven approach that also automates, and we'll get into the automation in a few, but automate certain aspects of your workflow as well. And here's kind of what I've picked up on, although, again, these phrases are a little loosey-goosey, and some people might use one, some people might use the other, and they're kind of referring to the same thing, but here's kind of what I've gleaned over the last few years. DAM, or digital asset management, it tends to be referring to relatively monumental systems that may kind of take this approach to organizing assets, automating workflow, but like at a, maybe an enterprise-wide level, getting into the distribution of assets to content distribution partners, tracking assets for kind of deployment of, and repurposing for websites or different kind of printed models.
I wonder what kind of DAM iStock photo has. you know.
And it's funny because they have more than one, right? Because they are a dam, but they probably have other things feeding into the dam that they use for internal purposes that the public never sees. So dam kind of is referring at once to the overarching system. It may actually combine several different systems that are plugged together through common standards like XML or at the API level or, you know, various systems. But digital asset management is almost like the philosophy. And I think the term evolved from the publishing industry because they were some of the first to kind of have these media assets like for magazine publishing or advertising, PR. And they needed to track like a product shot of a box of cereal sitting on a stool that might get used for a dozen different types of things. And they started building these databases to kind of track them and tag them and search for them. So DAM tends to be monumental. It may actually consist of more than one system. And again, some folks I've noticed tend to associate it more with graphic or photographic or logo or publishing oriented types of files and a little less of like audio and video. MAM is kind of the adaptation of that, the M being media and the media in media. I've found people tend to kind of be referring more to like multimedia, like audio and video, things that maybe have a time element in that media file. It's not just something that is a still image that's a flat file or multi-level, but it's one thing. You know, audio and video has this interesting fourth dimension of time, and media asset management systems tend to be the ones I've found that are referring to systems that kind of know how to make use of media that unfolds over time. So PAM, again, kind of, I think, originally talked about by Avid when referring to the Avid Interplay PAM system, which is now a little different than the Avid MAM system, which was acquired from Blue Order. But PAM is production asset management. And again, I'd say it's just a further, you know, drilling into the media asset management, but it's a particular media asset management tool that's really made for the production users themselves, the loggers, the editors, the producers. It's less monumental. It's less about feeding into publishing and distribution systems. It's often a little less oriented, although not necessarily, but perhaps less oriented at being kind of the front end to your massive archive database. It's more to solve the immediate moment-to-moment needs of the production and post-production level users. So I think that's it. And again, there's a lot of interchange between some of these words, and some people might call a PAM a MAM and a MAM a PAM.
The key part here is the A and the M. Asset management.
Yeah.
That is the thing that we're talking about today.
So we talked about the database. Maybe it's a good time to talk about this other personality, the evil twisted face of Harvey Dent, aka Two-Face. I'm not a geek, by the way. The workflow automation component.
So what exactly can be automated? So say
everything.
Let's set forth an example. Why don't we go with this production company that's producing, you know, maybe it's a two or three reality shows for a season. So they have a lot coming in and a lot going out. In that scenario where they have multiple camera sources for multiple productions, all concurrently coming in, being ingested on a regular basis, and then being edited just as quickly.
That's an adverb, folks.
Yes. I'm just a verb. I'm not going to do the whole thing. But so let's use that scenario as a basis for automation.
Sure. So when we talk about workflow automation, we mean like taking advantage of the fact that computers are really good at allowing you to kind of speed up the process that's involved with a set of tasks that you basically have to repeat over and over. So in the scenario you just gave, like what's one thing that happens all the time? Well, there's review and approval processes, right? You have editors working with producers or even producers working with loggers to kind of be mining this material and find good shots that they want to use when they're actually doing an edit, or an editor has a rough cut that they want to review with a producer. And it's basically this dynamic of someone is working, tagging, editing, and they need to get someone else's approval, right? So what can be automated there? Well, usually, you know, there's going to be some emails flying around. There's going to be maybe like taking something that was logged or edited in a camera native format, and someone might need to spit out a little web version and maybe even deposit it on like a server somewhere that the producer can log into on the Ethernet network or even across the internet, or just pull up a web page and take a look at it. Maybe that producer needs to get some notes back to the user who did the logging or the edit. You know, they need to kind of correspond a bit. They need to tell each other that something is ready for them to review. And then the person who does the review needs to feed back to the person who gave them that thing. Yes, this is approved. No, it's not approved. You need to make these further changes, right? That's a pretty typical review and approval process, right?
Sure. So how do we automate something like that?
So imagine this.
All over the place. I mean, like, there's so many moving parts.
Pretend you're watching Scooby-Doo and it's that like doodle-loot, doodle-loot, where everything kind of blurs.
I'm
and
gonna
it's
pretend
like
I'm watching Wayne's World, if that's okay.
Oh yeah, well yeah, did that too.
Yeah.
So okay, the alternate reality.
Tia Carrere. She was on The Apprentice, Celebrity Apprentice, last season.
Really?
Yeah, she was.
What's she doing these days?
Getting kicked off of Celebrity Apprentice.
Really?
Yeah, she didn't make it too far, but her personality did not do well in Donald's boardroom, I don't think. You know, between her and Luke,
I would think he would love her. I mean, he's Mr.
Well,
Ms.
You know,
Universe
he said,
or
he
whatever,
says,
right?
He says, I respect you and your work. And, you know, and then he says, you're fired. And, you know, he fired her along with the...
at least Lou, it was respectful.
Lou Ferrigno, you know, the original Hulk.
Lou? He got fired?
Yeah.
How could you fire the Hulk? I'd be, like, really scared of the consequences.
Well, he didn't do his job. That's why they fired him. Because
you're out of here, Hulk.
Every single task, what he wanted to do was, he says, well, you know, I can get up there and I can flex my muscles, you know. And like after a while, Lisa Lampanelli was like, you know, give it a break, Lou. Anyway, if you didn't
Hulk
watch
get welfare,
if you didn't watch The Celebrity Apprentice, you know, spoiler, Arsenio Hall won. All right. It was great. It was great. Arsenio
okay,
Hall,
so
he deserved it. He earned it.
Imagine in this alternative world of Lou Ferrigno and Tia Carrere living together happily ever after on their fantasy island, a database, an application that you as a logger or editor are using. Well, let's take it from the perspective of this imaginary editor. You've got this other little program running. Maybe it's CatDV, which is the media asset management, production asset management program that we've been deploying lots of lately and generally are quite happy with. We'll talk more about it in a more specific product-oriented episode where we're more clearly shilling for Chesapeake Systems.
Yes.
But anyway, imagine that you have this program, this database, and you've, even within this application, created a little rough cut. It lets you set endpoints, it lets you set out points, it lets you create some markers, and you can even do like a little string out edit, right? A paper edit, if you will, but digitally. Digital edit, but a rough cut, and you create a little sequence, and then that sequence becomes a new asset in the database. It doesn't get rid of all the other things. It was non-destructive editing, just like you're doing in a Final Cut project, but it's all within the context of this database that multiple people can look into. And you know now, ooh, I did this little rough cut as an editor. I need the producer to take a look at this. I'm gonna ta-ding, check the magic proverbial checkbox, ready for review, right?
So is that going to show up in a smart folder somewhere? Or?
So we could do so much, Merrill, so much.
I'm curious.
For instance, we could have the action of checking that metadata checkbox ready for review trigger an email notification.
Oh, we can put hooks into the mail server and just
oh,
send it
yeah.
out.
Yeah. Hooks into the mail server. We were doing that like back in the 70s. So we could trigger an email that knows to go to the particular producer that's associated with this show, because that show name has a certain set of users associated with it.
That's right.
It triggers an email notification to the producer saying this little rough cut sequence is ready for you. That sequence maybe gets deposited as an H.264 QuickTime movie in a particular folder on a server that the producer has access to. Maybe that email, and so checking the checkbox did the little transcode and turned the XDCam HD footage into a little mini H.264 web movie that the producer could easily get to from their wireless connection at Starbucks, where they're enjoying chocolate mocha macchiato with caramel on the top. Because I picture that's the kind of thing producers drink at Starbucks. But anyway.
It's usually bleach.
Oh, jeez. So they get an email. It says that this particular asset associated with this project is ready for review. Here's a link to the little H.264 version that was automatically generated and deposited on a server. It gives them a link to it in the email. They click on it. They click it, and it goes into like a web browser front end for the media asset management system. They don't have to be running the full media asset management app. They just launch into Safari, get pointed to a particular URL. The asset comes up. They can view that little H.264 version that was generated. And they even get a couple of fields that they can fill out, like some notes back to the editor and an either approved or not approved checkbox. And then they can make some notes, tell them it's approved, tell them it's not approved, give them some feedback. Hit a submit button. And that then feeds back into the media asset management database, which triggers more automations informing the editor that that's ready for them and it was not approved for the following reasons. And all of this, Meryl, triggered by the simple checking of a checkbox.
I have a question, though.
Oh, I bet you do.
I do have a question.
How much will this cost me?
No. My question actually is, are you saying that we can keep the producer out of the office with this process?
That is a major, major side effect, a.k.a. advantage.
Well, and also for all the field producers out there that are generally out for a week with the crews, then all the tapes, if they're shooting digital tape or whatever, they get, or even the cards or the hard drives are mailed back to the main area. You're still out in the forests of Oregon, which I don't know why you're doing a show there, but it's awesome.
Because you like the redwoods and the owls.
Yes, and all that other stuff that
dancing
comes with
naked
the rain
through the nature,
the rain and the. The local Oregonians
orangutans?
No. Oregon, we love you.
And your piercings. And
yes.
Angstful attitudes.
And your analog photography.
I think Goonies was filmed in Oregon, right?
But so if you're in the forests of wherever you are, and all
doing
that
rough
stuff,
cut edits out in the field.
Well, yeah, but I mean, because there's a local Starbucks, you can just. You can just log in there, and you don't ever have to go to home base. You know, it used to be the producer has to go to home base. They got to sit in an edit bay. They gotta drive the editor. They gotta sit there and say yes, no, maybe so.
Yep.
And now I got to get on a plane and go halfway across the country to do the next little bit.
So let's talk about a couple of other types of workflow automations. Another one is delivery. Right, I have finished an edit. That final piece is in the database, right? I now need to, let's say we are sending it to some kind of distribution partner and they need basically a digital file living on a server somewhere that you've sent to them in a very particular format. How about this? With an accompanying XML metadata file that feeds some types of specific information about the actual media file into their own content management system. Maybe you're feeding it into Drupal for a web-based system or one of countless other content management systems that maybe a broadcast partner like a Comcast or whoever might have, right? Well, again, through the proverbial checking of the magic checkbox, we could trigger a workflow automation that turns the camera native, edit native, formatted Final Cut of a project into one or dozens of different flavors of transcoded video for iPhone, for iPad, for, you know, Flash, for this, for that. WebM, if you ever decide to buy into Google's doomed to fail web, you know, video format, spit them into various, you know, password protected FTP directories across the interwebs, and extract from your own database the value of certain metadata fields that you have filled in yourself, and spits that stuff out as a specially formatted XML document that then gets sent to these FTP directories as well, that relate back to the files that you've delivered to them in these various formats. And again, maybe you've filled out some of the key fields like program name, episode number, you know, show name, brief description, some of the types of things that this distribution company may want in that metadata document so that it kind of automatically gets fed into their system. Again, we can do all of this in a totally automated fashion through this checking of the checkbox, if you will, or the changing of a metadata field from, you know, still in, you know, edit to ready for delivery status. There's a lot of ways we can do it. And we can also trigger these workflow automations through watch folder actions. You drop a file into a particular folder that has these various automations associated with them: transcoding, delivery, moving files around, triggering email notifications, what have you. And maybe by dropping a file into a watch folder somewhere, we trigger that. You know, another interesting thing that we do is we do these watch folder workflow automations on ingest. So let's say you've got a bunch of P2 footage that's coming in off the field, and you got a stack of P2 cards and you're dragging it onto the SAN. Well, maybe you drag things from particular cameras or particular shooters or particular locations into particular folders on the SAN. Those folders could have specific watch folder automations that pre-tag those media clips with at least a certain set of fields from the get-go based on the folder that they were dragged into. So, you know, oh, this came from this guy's camera. We know he was in Oregon, you know, shooting the redwoods and the owls,
and the rain.
You know, in, you know, 2008 or whatever. I mean, you have all of these things that you kind of pre-associate that you know are common to the material coming in off of this P2 card. Well, maybe if you just drag it into this particular folder, it gets cataloged into the media asset management system, pre-tags that stuff because of the particular folder that you dragged it into with a set of fields that's appropriate for stuff that's being dragged into that folder. Maybe even send some email notifications around to editors or loggers or producers. Hey, this is ready for you to start logging in more detail.
So this sounds like a pretty customizable set of features here.
Overwhelmingly customizable in many circumstances.
So, and this is the kind of thing that, you know, once we have a conversation with an individual organization, they let us know exactly how they would like their workflow to be,
yeah,
how they currently do it. And then we you know, put it all in a magic hat and make this work.
Let me give one more example of one of these workflow automations, and then let's maybe talk a little bit about potential challenges of these systems, because, you know, there is
a lot of variables here.
A lot of thinking, folks. So another one is, we were talking last week, part of the episode, about archive, right? And that a good physical format for archives is data tape. But the thing is, data tapes are not like a hard drive that you plug in, you can browse through the folders and just see what's there. They kind of tend to be a quote-unquote offline format, right? Well, let's say you've got all your content in one of these media asset management systems and you want to send something to archive tape because you don't really need it taking up room on your storage area network anymore. Maybe in your media asset management program, you got a whole little metadata section about the kind of archive aspects of a given media file. And you go into that archive section of your metadata, and you have a pop-up menu that basically determines what the archival state of that asset is. And you are ready to send it off to data tape. So you choose send to archive. And that triggers, boom, number one, the generation of a very, very small, lightweight proxy version of the movie. You know, maybe it's not full res, might not even be full frame range, although it might as well be. Maybe it's only like 500K or 1 megabit. It could be 1/100th the size of the original media file. And you're going to hold on to that. That will stay on your storage system. It will generate that proxy version. You're still going to have all of the metadata in your database, so you can still search for that thing. You can still watch the proxy, but this little changing of the metadata status for archive then actually sends the file into the archive system. The full res gets moved to tape. Once the system has confirmed that that move to data tape was successful, maybe it purges the full res version from the location on the SAN that it once resided at, but you've got the proxy that was generated as part of this process. You've got all of your metadata still in the database. It still exists as a record in the database. So if you then later on are doing a search and you find something and you're like, ooh, I need that, you go into your media asset management system's little archive section of the metadata and you say, oh, look, there's a note here that this is now on a data, this is in archive, but I can still view the proxy. Ooh, I like that. Well, part of that workflow automation we did was to have the archive system feed back into the MAM the barcode number of the tape that the full res is now living on. So that's right there in the MAM too. Say, oh, tape number 1234567 8. I can go to the shelf, find that tape, pop it in. Once it's in the tape library or the single tape drive, like a cache.
And we're talking LTO tape here.
Yeah,
not,
data
just
tape.
For
LTO 5, if you're on top of things. You pop it in, and now you've got a little automation that can be kicked off from within your MAM to restore from archive. And then you pull that full res back into the very original location it was on the SAN in the first place. And because it's in the original location, any project file you had that was referencing it originally, you won't have it be offline anymore because the full res is back right where it was, right where the project file points to. So that media asset management system as a front end to your archive system in terms of both automating the process of getting something to and from archive and automating the process of generating a proxy version of the asset that you can still look at and kind of meaningfully review, even though the full res that takes up most of the space is sitting on a tape on a shelf somewhere. That's another type of very common and useful workflow automation.
That would be, you know, because a lot of times when people want to, you know, do an archive of their video assets, they still want to have access to them fairly ready. You know, they don't, let me say that again.
They don't want to hunt through stacks of data.
Yeah, they want to be able to recall this fairly quickly. Fair, I can't talk today.
I think readily was the word.
Readily was the word, but it just wasn't coming out. They
readily
want to be able to
doesn't
recall.
Sound like a
readily,
real word.
It sounds like a website, you know? No, they want to be able to recall the tape, you know, without having to go dig and without having to reinvent the wheel just to get some old assets back. I mean, it's very convenient to be able to certainly reference the existing proxy, and it, you know, because sometimes you got to go pull something from archive anyway, and then you realize it's not the thing that you want. So this eliminates that entirely.
Yeah, you've got that proxy to review to confirm, oh yes, this is what we want. And I mean, there's so much more these databases do. Like, you know, a media asset management database, again, I mentioned it kind of briefly before, but you can do your subclipping and the naming of subclips, the tagging of subclips, the generation of markers, all within the asset management program, like a CatDV or another, and then spit those subclips and markers right into a project file. So you can...
Is that XML-based?
It tends to be XML behind the scenes, even if you're not explicitly spitting out an XML file. Like, you know, CatDV and Final Cut 7 have this very direct interplay where you can drag clips, subclips, and markers, that maybe you generated from within CatDV in the first place, right into a Final Cut project file, but you don't actually even have to drag between application windows. The Final Cut 7 project file that's up and running on your computer at that moment, actually CatDV sees that it's running, and you can drag right into there, and then you drag those things in, and then you flip back over to Final Cut, and boom, it's created a new kind of sub bin with the data on it that has those things that you just dragged in from CatDV. So it's It's very slick and directly tied together.
Other we see that functionality with Premiere Pro as well, right?
Premiere Pro is evolving. Like with again, this is very specific to the individual asset management programs, but like with Cat TV, you can spit out an actual explicit Final Cut 7 XML file. And because the Adobe guys were really smart and decided they wanted Premiere to be able to understand Final Cut XML, you could then import that Final Cut XML file into Premiere Pro and it would work okay. However, we found that the latest version of the Final Cut XMLs that were getting spit out of Cat TV didn't work quite so perfectly with Premiere Pro, and that is getting like updated in the next major version of Cat TV, which is 10, which is coming in a few months. So again, these things are so complex and there's so many potential workflows that, like, you know, talking to some experts like the guys at Chesapeake Systems.
Who are they?
The guys that we're shilling for, Meryl.
They're good looking, I hear.
But we're not technically shilling if we're very open about the fact that we work for Chesapeake Systems. And yes, we'd love for you to buy more things from us.
But if not, that's okay too, because we're awesome.
As long as you're our friends and give this podcast like a 5-star review on iTunes and say, you know, I'm never going to buy anything.
That's shilling. Right now,
us.
Right now, what you're doing is shilling. You totally rolled over there and started shilling.
I'm just a shill.
I guess so. But
I'm just a shill and nobody
So okay. Loves me. So let's redirect here for a second. So there's a lot of automation that can happen here.
A lot of searching,
we've talked about all this automation. It needs really to rely heavily on what your parameters are.
Yeah.
So we know that it's very important, garbage in, garbage out, because none of this automation process is going to matter if the foundation of the way that your metadata tagging
the quality of the metadata tagging, and but not just the act of doing the tags, the act of as an organization having thought through what tags should exist in the first place. What are the various fields of metadata, or do we need different fields for different types of media or different projects that we're working on? You know, are some fields very important for one show we're working on, but we could care less about, you know, a field, something specific for another type of show we're working on? Maybe we do 30-minute or 30-second commercials and we do 22-minute television as well, and there may be some types of metadata that you want Logger to tag for stuff that's intended for one that is really not even relevant to the other. You know, so thinking through the metadata and then the not only the fields, but what values should you allow someone to choose from when populating a field, again, because we want to kind of force them into a set of choices versus open-ended. Thinking that through as an organization is really important. And the nice thing is, here's a homework assignment, folks. You can do a lot of this thinking very meaningfully before even deploying the system. In fact, kind of writing a lot of this stuff down in like an Excel spreadsheet or a Word
document.
You've
kind of been doing it already. If you're an editor worth his salt, you've been building the basic blocks of what your parameters need to be.
Yes, although I will say this. Like, I was at one of our clients a day or two ago, and you know, we were asking about their logging process. In fact, we were at a couple of different clients, and they basically said the same thing, that logging takes up a huge amount of time, and it's extraordinarily important. These guys do reality TV, so their shooting ratios can be like 50 to several hundred to one, 50 hours to several hundred hours of raw material that they shoot and put on their SAN to every hour that gets on TV. And logging is a hugely important process. It takes up ridiculous amounts of time. They said up to twice as much time as the actual number of hours of the footage it then takes to log it. So for every 100 hours of raw material that's going to make an hour of real television, it may take 200 hours to log it. And you know what? They didn't have super well-defined kind of note-taking systems for the loggers. We're doing a lot of kind of open-ended notes, and it wasn't extraordinarily well-defined. They didn't necessarily have a specific set of tags that a logger should even put in that Word document or whatever they're using to do those log notes. So thinking this through is a challenge, and we can help you with that, but your organization is going to know which search criteria will suit individual projects that you're working on best. And so do the homework up front. Deploying these systems is much easier if you think through, again, what should our taxonomy be? What are the terms, the fields, the values for fields? Think that through. And remember the Goldilocks principle? You want to be able to do a search where you or have a smart folder that you could have like maybe 3 to 5 fields or 5 to 10 fields that you're doing a search on that are going to like give you a few assets for you to browse through. But it's not going to give you a search result of 100 things, and it's not going to give you a search result of 1 thing. You want your fields to be granular enough so it's really meaningfully limiting what you have to search through, but not limiting it too much or too little, right?
Nick, is there anybody that shouldn't be using a MAM?
Well, you know, you can buy a desktop copy of CatDV for like $400, and I think even an individual editor sitting at home will be well served by that if they're an organized kind of person. There are organizations, you know, speaking of these challenges, that have a harder time rolling these systems out. Not to say that it can't happen and it can't be successful, but like, let's say you have a 30 edit system and environment, and at any given moment 25 of those 30 seats are populated by freelancers. They may be there for a day, they may be there for a week, or they may be there for a month, and they're shifting in and out, and their main job is as editors. Well, getting them trained not only to edit the shows that you want in the way you want them to do it, but how to tag things in the way you want them to tag them, especially because this person's going to be out of there in 2 months and they're never going to probably see the direct benefits of having entered these tags in the first place. You know, that benefit may come 2 years down the road when you want to find that asset again. The freelancer could care less about that, right? Getting them to buy in on it.
He wouldn't.
Yeah, they don't. Getting them trained on it, taking a both carrot and stick approach to getting them to do it, it can be a big challenge. And we've seen some organizations that we put in a MAM for, they're very excited about it, and then it can be a challenge to get their users to use it, especially users who aren't really super wed to the organization's long-term goals, you know, in general.
And I think this is an important point to make, which is that somebody needs to manage this process. In your organization, this is not some magic bullet that you can just purchase, implement, and then reap the benefits of. There needs to be somebody who really understands both the post-production workflow as it exists in your organization, somebody who understands just exactly what the requirements are as far as metadata tagging,
yes,
and certainly somebody to oversee this process. So if you, in this example, you have a lot of freelance editors, it is the onus is on the organization really to have somebody there to oversee this process.
Yeah, I've heard them referred to as like a data wrangler. In a sense, it's kind of being like a digital librarian or a digital archivist. I've heard this title referred to as the media operations manager, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a dedicated person, but there needs to be a person who clearly in their job description, as the set of responsibilities that they are charged with and are being, you know, evaluated on, is the proper usage and maintenance and upkeep and management of this asset management system. Someone's got to kind of be orchestrating its use, its design. And, you know, we were talking about all the thinking that needs to go into metadata fields. That's great for those search functionalities, but then we were talking about these limitless workflow automation possibilities. Someone needs to be the one who literally sits in front of a piece of paper and draws workflow diagrams that kind of outline the processes of the organization and the various, you know, various aspects of workflow that may be going on, both in the field, in production, in the act of logging and ingesting, the act of editing and review and approval, and then the act of delivery. All of these systems need to kind of be outlined so then we can figure out, working with you, we as an integrator for these types of systems, hey, well, here's some potential bottlenecks. We're identifying things that are, you're going through these steps again and again, but we can probably automate a lot of this to speed up people's time so they don't need to be necessarily sitting there waiting for a transcode to happen and then manually plopping that file on a server. we can make this checkbox stuff so you can check it and then go on with some other tasks that you're assigned to. But we need to understand what those processes are, and someone needs to be charged with thinking them through it. Maybe your post-production supervisor. You kind of really need, as David is holding up on a sign here, an evangelist within your organization.
You need a Tammy Faye Baker ma'am. Is that
a Tammy
wrong?
Ma'am?
A Tammy ma'am?
So that's right. You get all evangelical on that. Because we evangelize
for
these systems all the time.
You need to proselytize the data entry. You got to be in there and you got to be like, this is the way to do it and this is why.
I go to these conferences like Digital Asset Management New York that Henry Stewart Events puts on. It's a great conference. We'll put it in the show notes. And I encourage people to spend the like $1,400 or $1,500 admission fee for the 2 days, because it's a lot of good quality folks and very quality sessions. And many of the people who go to this show are the folks who have been kind of assigned the role within their organization. It could be a smaller production company. It could be a mega corporation. There's folks there from government agencies, folks there. We always run into
the UN
and UNICEF. We run into folks from major consumer corporations, major broadcasters. And it tends to attract the kind of folks who are these data wranglers / librarian / archivist / asset management system evangelists within their organizations. And a lot of them won't lie. Sometimes they're walking around with a whip or a cat of nine tails within their organization and abusing people who aren't using the system properly.
And leather.
Yeah, it's a very dominatrixy kind of thing.
Yeah.
They have to kind of prod people into keeping up with the system, because the efficiencies that, it's not just a wasted exercise. The efficiencies that are gained, either later on or by another individual who happens to be sitting across from you, who's doing the searching based on the tags that you're putting in, they're enormous. I mean, people wouldn't put these systems in if all they were was a waste of time. They save time. And by saving time, they can allow you to produce more and make you more money. But still, it's a sea change in thinking. And it's thinking more about a very holistic approach to your workflow. The tagging of things, your processes, the workflow itself, automation, and automating components thereof.
A little bit more in
on
the front
end. It's a new
way
of thinking.
Yeah, a little bit, and that's right. A lot of times there's so much going on in the production process and the post-production process that and deadlines are always a factor here. As far as, what do you do when you're under a deadline and you got to get a cut done? And my point of view is always a little bit more on the front end, and it's going to save you a lot on the back end versus the other way around. I mean, say you're doing a multiple season television show. You're on the third season. You need those assets from season one. Maybe you're doing a flashback. Maybe you need some of the B-roll. Maybe you need to recut it for some reason. I mean, there are so many things, and you don't want to just go back to the finished product. You might want to go back to the original assets and that little bit of extra time.
Oh, gosh.
It's going to save your ass.
Yes, it will. Your
it's
assets.
It's going
save
to
your
save
assets.
Your assets.
So, I should say, and kind of in line with that, different MAM platforms have different emphases. If you think this system that requires this much thinking, this much automation is just overwhelming, and you like the idea of some of the benefits, but this seems too overwhelming for you, there are some systems that have the characteristics of a MAM. One we're starting to work with, and we'll have a demo system set up relatively soon, is called Focal Point, and it's actually from the same company that does CatDV. It's interesting because Focal Point understands that, listen, the project file itself in many workflows still is the center of your workflow. And Focal Point gives you a I'll call it a collaboration and workflow management system that is really all about tracking project files and less about tracking the individual pieces of media, but tracking these project files, actually creating project files, say for Final Cut or for Photoshop or After Effects from within this other little program. When you create a project file, it just forces an editor or a logger to just fill out a couple of fields really quickly. Those get stamped into the file name. So it's really good at forcing people to kind of create file names that adhere to these file naming conventions. And again, you're baking basically pieces of metadata into the project file names, and people are doing this without even really having to think about it. They just fill out these 4 or 5 metadata fields, and boom, those are getting stamped in the names. And then it has these whole versioning systems, checking in, checking out for the project files, and then notification systems to tie people in the organization together. Hey, this project file is ready for you to review. This project file, you know, is ready for someone to kind of render out. And again, you may derive a lot of benefits as far as extra efficiency within your organization taking a more limited approach and looking at a tool that maybe kind of still assumes that the project file are the heart of your workflow, and you're not quite ready to make the database itself the heart of your workflow. And yet you can still get a lot of these advantages. So there's a lot of different approaches. You know, some MAM, DAM systems, PAMs are better at media files that do have a time element. If you're looking for something that's more for photos or graphic files, we may be able to stretch a tool that's mostly oriented around video or audio into also allowing you to work with your graphical or photographic elements, or you may want to combine multiple systems. There's so many approaches. I know that we here at Chesapeake think through a lot of this stuff with our clients on a daily basis. So you're going to want to really think through this and, frankly, work with an outfit like Chesapeake that spends a huge amount of our time in a many different environments, each of which are unique, to kind of really hash out what you're trying to execute with a project like this. So, we cover most of it.
Do we want to hammer in again about how this?
You haven't been recording, have you?
No, it's recording.
Oh, okay. You just had this look in your eye, like, oh my goodness.
No, it's recording. Yeah, no, we just wasted the last hour. We haven't done a damn thing.
But have we done a MAM thing?
How
about a PAM thing?
Well, you know,
do we need to push more about, in the end, this saves money? Do we need to retest that again?
Well, you know, it doesn't just save money, it saves your ass. I mean, this is a long-term approach that, you know, frankly, again, it's like more in on the front end saves you money on the back end. You know, an implementation of a MAM is not something small.
And it's not free. You know,
a time and amount of energy
stuff. Apple really screwed the pooch for a lot of us when they released Final Cut Server for $1,000, and they made it seem like, oh, this is for anyone. You can just install it on your editing system, and suddenly all your assets are managed. When that was like the furthest thing from the truth. Final Cut Server, which we were heavily involved with for many years before it kind of died on the vine, was an asset management system and very sophisticated on many levels. And even though it was $1,000 to buy the box of software, the hardware infrastructure to support it, because you need to run these things on servers and sometimes you need additional storage space for proxies and things like that, that might be $10,000 or $10,000s. And then the professional services to roll it out may have been $10,000 or $10,000s. These are not small scale projects necessarily, especially for a larger organization. Again, the amount of time saved and efficiency gained and just smoothness to the operation makes it so this is as the folks in the military say, a force multiplier. This lets a person do more for every day that they show up at work. I mean, again, we were talking about a system that combines some of the aspects of asset management with these clients over the last few days that we thought could cut their logging time into a tenth of what it currently is. This is the combination of this very cutting-edge speech and phrase searching software with an asset management system. And it's like, you can take your loggers and you're paying them X amount, and now you can multiply that by 0.1, and that's their new time and cost. And you can either repurpose them for different tasks, you can have them logging 10 times as much material. I mean, again, an asset management system in and of itself isn't necessarily going to do that, but these types of systems with these types of investments associated sometimes can save so much time and money and energy on at one point or another in your workflow and the various bottlenecks.
It can save your ass.
Yeah.
It can save your ass. I can't stress it enough. I mean, those are just the facts, ma'am.
So, We're very open about having very in-depth conversations with folks about it. Obviously, we're Nick and Merrill with Chesapeake Systems. You can learn a little bit more about asset management systems and many other things on our website, chesa.com, C-H-E-S-A.com. Go to the pro video and media section and you can learn more. We'll have show notes with plenty of this subject and links to some of the things we've been talking about. You know, we are on the iTunes store now. Please give us a great rating if you've liked what you've heard here today. And next week, OTT?
Yeah, you know me.
OTT for you and me. OTT, a.k.a. Over the Top.
And I'm love not that movie.
I'm not
I love that
about
movie. It's
the
my favorite movie.
I'm not talking about the arm wrestling movie with Sylvester
it's
Stallone.
It's my favorite movie ever. It's like my number one movie.
I learned everything I know about
father
arm wrestling.
Son story right there. I'm telling you.
I learned everything I know about arm wrestling from that movie.
So you didn't learn much, did you?
You've seen my arms. They're nothing to write home about. They do the thing where, like in a cartoon, you make the muscle thing and it literally droops down.
You make a U?
Yeah, yeah.
I see. And on that note.
No, over the top, though, over the top broadcasting, the just dramatic shifts taking place now that anyone can kind of be their own broadcaster and deliver their content across the internet, how easy and cheap that is, the disruption to the media landscape. OTTs is kind of the abbreviation for that. That's what we're getting into next week on Workflow Show 106.
See you guys.
Bye-bye.